been out here for so long, the road it just stretches on till I stop pretending.
Hello and welcome to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3, Sydney's local and independent current affairs. I'm Miles Holbrook-Walk. Today on Razor's Edge...
Once the remainder of a meal that I cooked in a pot, somebody ate it and then chucked the pot in the bin. It just seems like not worth it to even bother to be around enough to save money and to cook.
The housing market in Sydney may be going down in price, but it can still be unaffordable for those trying to snap up a home. In the final story of the Razor's Edge housing series, we look into the underground option people turn to when they can't afford anything else. Also coming up on Razor's Edge...
This is a government that is committed to the agenda of...
Do you live on the outskirts of Sydney and feel the effects of urban sprawl? Well, the New South Wales government recently announced a new initiative that aims to increase the amount of people living outside Sydney. The initiative hopes to expand the city's fringe to 80 kilometres southwest of Sydney's central business district. But will this work? And what does it mean for regional Australia? All that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first, thousands of protesters gathered outside the Sydney Opera House on Tuesday in protest to radio broadcaster Alan Jones's comments about the National Treasure's sales being used for advertising. People from around the country weighed in on the debate and in turn split the country over the question, should one of Australia's greatest icons be used as an advertising billboard? Evangeline Maguire has the report.
On Tuesday night, thousands of Sydneysiders marched outside the Sydney Opera House to protest against the commercialisation of Sydney's most iconic treasure. The light-based protest was in response to the comments radio broadcaster Alan Jones made to CEO of the Sydney Opera House, Louise Herron, on Friday, after he called for Ms. Herron to be sacked during an on-air debate about the promotion of a horse race event called the Everest on the sales of the Sydney landmark.
Why?
Not a billboard.
Who said? Who said? You! Who the hell do you... Hang on, Louise, who do you think you are? If I were Gladys Berejiklian, I'd pick up the phone and sack you today.
Alan Jones's comments sparked a national debate. Should one of Australia's most recognisable landmarks be used...
And it's appropriate that we treat it respectfully.
But Premier of New South Wales, Gladys Berejiklian, disagreed.
We would never do anything that wouldn't support the iconic stature of the Opera House, but it is also...
My journey, I've calculated, that's an extra 240 hours a year just because I can't get out of Redfern.
Did you know that Redfern Station only has one lift available for those who are disabled? A crowd took to Redfern streets to protest against the inaccessibility of this station and those around Sydney. Also coming up on Razor's Edge...
Room is generally considered the worst film of all time, a genuinely god-awful film.
Hundreds of people every month go to North Sydney to see one of the worst films ever made. The film is described as the Citizen Kane of bad movies. So why do people go and see it? All that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first, nurses at Blackdown Hospital in Sydney's western suburbs have called for more security measures after a staff member was recently slashed by a patient. Here's a grab from Channel 9's reporter Damien Ryan, who was at the scene when the story was unfolding.
A patient gained access to a staff tea room and armed himself with two knives. When the nurse tried to escort him out, he lunged at her, slashing her with the knife, cutting her arms and wrists.
In response, the government wants to employ greater security staff on hospital premises, but will this remedy the problem? Allegra Short has the story.
On the 27th of August, a patient wielding two knives assaulted a nurse at Blacktown Hospital. This incident has come after a string of security breaches in New South Wales hospitals and puts into question the safety of healthcare workers. Wendy Tilden is the nurses' unit manager at the acute aged care ward at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital and believes that occupational violence is an issue that needs to be addressed.
Sort of another case, I had a lady and her mother was in a bed area that she didn't want her mother to be in, and she sort of stood to me almost nose to nose and sort of said, you know, if my mother falls tonight, then it's all your fault and you will be to blame for it. And so that's the sort of just really nasty. And then she walked away. So that's another example of a low-level violence that actually I wouldn't get security up for that. I wouldn't even hardly document that happening. You know, we wouldn't write that up as an incident report.
Should that be written up as an incident report?
Yeah, it probably would be. But if we wrote up everything that family members and patients said or did to us, there would be not enough hours in the day to write them up as incidences, let alone manage them.
Judith Cater is the Assistant General Secretary at the New South Wales Nurses and Midwives Association and believes that the increases of hospital violence is due to a number of issues.
I do think that the reasoning is multifaceted, but it basically gets down to we don't have enough people to do the job that the community demands in hospitals, and hospitals have a way of triaging to make sure that the sickest gets seen first, and sometimes that upsets people that are waiting. And similarly on a ward, you always have to attend to the priority issue first, and if that means someone else has got to wait, it does seem in modern days that nobody likes to wait. The other thing is the rise in mental health issues, and that is a particularly vexed issue, and it's also multifaceted in its own right. But I'm not sure that the recent changes to have people coming through the ED departments with mental health issues is the best way to serve those people.
With mental health related issues on the rise within Australia and New South Wales, Judith does not feel enough is being done to support these people.
I think we've seen in recent times, just here in Sydney, that has developed into full-blown incidents, both at Blacktown and Nepean. I think that it's something that is definitely on the rise. I know that we have been working with the Ministry of Health over a number of years to try and mitigate that rise, but I don't think we're keeping pace with the demands of the services.
In a response to the rise in occupational violence experienced by nurses, the Minister for Health, Brad Hazzard, has come out in support of greater security staff being employed on hospital grounds. In a recent interview with 2GB's Chris Smith, he says,
security issues in our hospitals and looking at a whole range of factors. So first of all, I mean, do we need more? That's a question. Secondly, do they, and this is where it gets really complex, do they need to be special constables? In other words, should they be in police-type uniforms? Yeah. And that's a really difficult one, because even talking to nursing staff again this morning, nurses and doctors often have a different view on that. Yeah. They think that sometimes a uniform can be particularly... It can cause more grief if somebody who's got a mental health issue or drug and alcohol has a police-looking uniform.
However, Judith Cater does not feel this is enough.
Yeah, look, that's one way. But again, you've got to make sure that that remedy really fits your problem. I think there's more to it than that. Obviously, we would never say no to more security, because the more hands that there are on deck, the better the outcomes, but I'm just not quite sure where they're going to put them.
Judith Cater, Assistant General Secretary at the New South Wales Nurses and Midwives Association, ending that report by Allegra Short. If this report triggered anything alarming for you, then you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
In the House, cult film classics returns to Event Cinemas George Street November 12 and 14 with the ultimate John Hughes classic, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
Don't miss your favourite cult classics now on Monday and Wednesday nights, because life is too beautiful a thing to waste. Hosted by the Movie Nerds. Check the full film list and grab tickets at eventcinemas.com.au. Event Cinemas George Street sponsors 2SER 107.3.
I'm Evie Maguire and you are listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. I went to a protest last week that took place outside Redfern Station. People took to the streets to protest against public transport's inaccessibility for the disabled community. There is only one lift at Redfern Station and it can be only accessed from Platform 6 and 7. The protesters said this was a huge inconvenience and is an example of a bigger issue. Against the backdrop of mounting calls for equal public transport access, a crowd of people stretched outside Redfern Station in protest for more disability access.
Equal transportation!
There are 965 train stations across Australia, and only one in four can be accessed by wheelchair without help. Redfern Station is one of Sydney's oldest train stations and in 1999 was added to the New South Wales State Heritage Register. It has 12 platforms in total and just one lift, which is on Platform 6 and 7. The lift was announced in 2013 by the then Transport Minister Gladys Berejiklian and completed in 2015. However, the lift is only accessible to those passengers travelling on the Inner West Line. For commuters like Andrew Emerson, this is a big inconvenience. Mr. Emerson has to add an extra 30 minutes to his journey to work every morning, which he totaled up to be 240 hours a year because he can't get out at the correct Redfern station where the lift is located.
I work opposite Redfern train station, so it's a bit inconvenient for me to, you know, come to a station that's right literally beside my employment, and I can't access, you know, the platform to get off, you know, to get to my work. I've got to, you know, add an extra half hour each way to my journey. I've calculated that's an extra 240 hours a year just because I can't get out of Redfern.
Mr. Emerson is a 47-year-old paraplegic and has limited use of his arms, so he relies on a wheelchair to get around. He said it is easier for him to walk from Central to Redfern as opposed to getting the train.
Central to Redfern, definitely there are times because I can only get the train that actually gets to the platform at Redfern that's accessible. So in time, it's quicker for me to walk from Central to Redfern. And I enjoy it, you know, walking through the park as well. So it has its other benefits too.
Earlier this year, New South Wales Transport Minister Andrew Constance announced some new initiatives to help people with disabilities get around the Sydney community.
Since coming to government, we've now delivered 38 accessible stations. We've now been able to provide 90% of commuters with access to accessible stations, and we're going to continue the program. We're going to get this job done. Very pleasingly today, I think it's great to be able to announce a couple of new commuter car parks, plus new lifts and accessibility at a number of stations across the network. Very pleasing news for people right across the Sydney Trains network.
Despite Mr. Constance's announcement for new car parks and lifts, Samantha French, Senior Policy Officer at People with Disability Australia, said there are broader access issues that need to be implemented.
We need to look beyond just getting lifts put in. We need to look at accessible communication, information, having audible announcements, having adequate staffing on stations, that type of thing.
According to the Bureau of Statistics, in 2014, Redfern Station was ranked 7 in the top 40 busiest stations during morning peak hour. Between 6 a.m. and 9:30 a.m, 10,048 passengers exited from Redfern Station. Despite these high numbers, on the Transport for New South Wales website, it outlines that Redfern Station is not wheelchair accessible. Robin Eames, Disability and Carer Officer at Sydney University, spoke at the protest in Redfern and called for something to be done.
40% of UCID students use Redfern Station to get to class. 50,000 commuters pass through it every day, and a fifth of the population is disabled. And there is only one left.
Local resident Hayden also spoke at the event. They were late because they are legally blind and couldn't see the bus to get to the protest in time. For Hayden, being severely vision impaired means public transport is the only option.
It's incredibly difficult trying to navigate train stations, bus stops and ferry walls as a blind person. The signs in the stations are impossible for me to read unless I stand less than a metre away, which often isn't possible, and the text on the signs at bus stops are so small that I can't see them no matter how close I get. There are no auditory announcements at bus stops, and those at train stations lack important information such as when the next train is due.
A spokesperson at Redfern Station said that they are, quote, working on it, unquote. But for commuters like Andrew Emerson, Robin Eames and Hayden, change isn't coming fast enough. Mr. Emerson again.
I am a taxpayer and I do have the right to, you know, have access to all of it. The amount of train stations nowadays are still inaccessible when by 2017 they were supposed to be 90%, you know, accessible for all in the Sydney metropolitan network. And they're not. It's just very inconvenient. If part of my journey is inaccessible, then my whole journey is inaccessible.
Andrew Emerson, Finance and IT Support Officer at the People with Disability Australia, ending that report.
Celebrate Parramatta's birthday. Join us for Parramatta Foundation Day, a free, family-friendly event. Enjoy a day under the jacaranda trees with live music, market stalls, family games and activities, historic audio tours of the female factory grounds, classic car displays and more. There's something for everyone. Sunday, November 4, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Heritage Precinct, North Parramatta. City of Parramatta sponsors 2SER.
I'm Evie Maguire and you are listening to Razor's Edge, coming to you live from this place known as Sydney on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. Every month, a cinema in North Sydney puts on a 15-year-old film described as the Citizen Kane of bad movies. Despite the film's abysmal critical response, hundreds of people turn out to watch it every screening and yell along with every line of cringe-worthy dialogue. So how has The Room, an American film directed by a mysterious figure called Tommy Wiseau, created a cult following in Sydney? Miles Holbrook-Walk brings you this story.
What is the worst film you have ever seen?
The Room is generally considered the worst film of all time, a genuinely god-awful film.
It's really just like nothing else that you've ever seen. You kind of can't believe what's unfolding in front of your eyes. It makes no sense, but it feels like it's meant to be serious.
It's popular for how bad it is.
These people are all describing the same film. It's called The Room, and it was directed, written, and paid for by this mysterious guy called Tommy Wiseau.
The most interesting thing about him is that no one really knows who he is. Over time, the interest has kind of shifted from the film to the person behind the film and who could actually be responsible for such a masterpiece or terrible film, depending which way you look at it.
But the weird thing is, all of these people have rewatched this movie over...
I have seen it probably about three times in its entirety.
Over...
I've seen the film five times.
And over again.
I'd guess it'd be into the 20s or 30s by now. I haven't really kept track of it, but yeah, a lot of times.
Stranger still, they've all watched it at the same place, in a cinema that has hosted this film for the last 6 years, every month, to hundreds of people at each screening. Just a heads up, if you haven't seen the film, it follows a guy whose best friend has an affair with his fiancée, leading to an untimely betrayal that ultimately ends in his dramatic but very unbelievable death. But all you really need to understand is this. When it came out in 2003, it was panned by everyone. Cinemas showing the film originally put up signs saying there were no refunds for this film. Hardly something you see often. So, how is it a film both critics and audiences despise ended up becoming a multi-million dollar cult classic?
I'll call myself, like, a long-term observer, you know, of The Room.
Olive is a self-described Room observer and explained how they first came across the movie.
So me and a lot of my friends from high school that we watched it the first time while, like, stoned in each other's rooms.
And it's this sharing around of The Room that Olive loves.
Everyone who has found The Room has then, at some point, recommended it to someone and just been like, have you seen this? oh, you haven't seen this. Oh my God, you need to watch this right now. Essentially, you can feel like the person that has found this insane thing and you're showing this to someone and getting that kind of like, you know, a shocked amazement kind of reaction out of someone else. It's very addictive.
Olive reckons the film has basically become a meme, but not your typical meme. Not one that gets shared around before fading into obscurity a few months later.
Well, I think it has the kind of the... has, like, the meme effect, you know? Like, it's so quotable. Yes, it is a meme, but it's also, like, a movie. So it's about 50 memes in one. People get over one meme after, like, a couple months, but people don't get over 50 memes all, like, relating to each other in a complex web of, like, shitness, you know? That takes a while. Maybe in 20 years, we'll see it get over and done with.
For almost everyone who's seen this film, it's filled with these weird moments, and Olive, like every fan, of course, has a favourite.
I just love... my favourite part of it, I think, is just his laugh. It just has this very, very specific laugh. Oh, it's so out of place and beautiful. I love it.
And that laugh? But it's not just the film that's unique. It's where people are going to watch it. So I went to the Orpheum, the self-professed home of the room, and it's like stepping back in time. The people working there wear deep burgundy coats and black bow ties out of the 1930s.
So it's a beautiful old heritage-listed 1935 building, Art Deco design, which has been beautifully restored to its former glory.
Alex Tamishvari is the general manager of the Orpheum, and he told me how the cinema was saved from the brink of destruction by a TV star 40 years ago.
Mike Walsh, the award-winning television presenter and celebrity, he took on the Orpheum, basically on the verge of being demolished almost, very run-down state at that point, and he took it on as a real passion project and restored it.
Alex was actually the person who decided to bring the room to the Orpheum.
We actually took it on about 6 years ago and have run it monthly since then. Now, this literally brings in hundreds of people every single month. The peak of our screenings last year, we were literally selling out all 700 seats every single month.
700 people came to watch a film not only that was made 15 years ago, but is also described as one of the worst ever made.
Absolutely, and that the irony of that is not lost on us. We've always known we've had something special with the room. I mean, right from our initial screenings, where it hadn't actually screened in Sydney for quite some time, you know, we got a huge response. So there's always been hundreds of people coming, but even now, the interest in the room just hasn't waned. I mean, people are still so fascinated by this movie.
So we're a little clearer on the room and the Orpheum, but what I still don't understand is how hundreds of people every month in Sydney turn out for this film. But I've found someone who might have those answers. Dr. Renee Middlemost works at the University of Wollongong and has presented an academic paper on the room, and she says the film's success is owed to its fans.
People are actually just trying to understand what this movie is about, and what I talk about in the paper is really... over time, the interest has kind of shifted from the film to the person behind the film and who could actually be responsible for such a masterpiece or terrible film, depending which way you look at it.
In her paper on the room, Renee raises this idea of paratexts, and it's quite complex, so I'll just leave it to her to explain it.
Simply, a paratext is anything that's drawn from an original text that adds to the experience. So it can be stuff like a soundtrack, but it can be anything that kind of explains or helps to define or support the films. In the case of The Room, paratexts are there to try and help us give extra meaning. So paratexts around The Room, I think, have been really popular because it kind of gives the illusion that we can learn more about both the film and what it actually means and possibly Tommy Wiseau.
I realise that an academic talking about one of the worst films ever made is ridiculous. But what's even more ridiculous? I found more than 100 papers that discussed The Room in an academic sense. There's one scientific paper dedicated to discovering how much force it would require to rip the main character's arms off. If you're wondering, it's inspired by the main character, Johnny, being emotionally torn apart.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
Ultimately, though, to understand this film, and I'm going to level with you, I've been trying to understand it for 3 years, since I first saw it at the Orpheum. you have to watch it. So I took Evie Maguire, who works with us here at 2SER, to see this film at the Orpheum. And unlike everyone else in this story, Evie has never heard of The Room. Ever. So we're at the Orpheum, and like anyone going to the movies, the first thing Evie comes across is the litany of plastic spoons. There's more than 1,000 of them.
I've actually got a handful right here, as you can probably hear them rustling in the background. You don't know what we do with these spoons, do you?
No, can I just say, I have never seen anything like this before. I've never gone to the cinema with plastic spoons in my hand. Why do I need these?
So Evie and I are talking, and I see someone dressed up as the main character of the film. He introduced himself as Tommy. Yep, the same name as the star and director of The Room. And like any true fan, of course, Tommy gave me his own impression of the man he was dressed up as.
The most famous line of the film is, I did not hit her, I did not, it's bullshit, I did not hit her, I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Surprisingly, though, it was his first time seeing the film at the Orpheum. He's already seen it 5 times.
You've seen a film 5 times. Why come to watch it at a cinema now on the 6th occasion? Surely a lot of people would watch a film a couple of times and think, oh, well, I know that film inside out. I might go and watch something else.
Because my girlfriend, who may be my ex-girlfriend after this evening, hasn't seen it.
So the screening is pure pandemonium. Two people even start throwing an American football in the same scenes where the characters are doing that. And as for what Evie thought about the film?
I'm speechless. I've never been to anything like it before, ever. I mean,
what happened in it?
Essentially, it was people screaming and throwing spoons the whole night and chatting the whole time. You could barely follow the plot.
I mean, yeah, and if you had to, I mean, Margaret and David give scores out of 5, famous film critics. Is there one for you?
I'd rate Tonight 4 out of 5 stars, but I'd actually give the movie itself 0.5 star.
The more I think about this film, the less I understand it. And truly, that's the mastery of it. It is enigmatic. Alex Tamishvari from The Orpheum, he had one take on it that explains at least part of the phenomenon.
The main ingredient to its success is that it has been made by someone who is earnestly trying to make a legitimate masterpiece of dramatic cinema.
Maybe it's best not to try understand something like The Room too much. I'll leave the last word on explaining this film to the person who gifted it to us. Ladies and gentlemen, Tommy Wiseau.
If a lot of people love each other, the world would be a better place to live.
You can catch screenings of The Room the first Friday night of every month at the Orpheum in Cremorne. And don't worry, they supply the spoons.
Miles Holbrook-Walk ending that report. Now, Sydney isn't exactly known for its vast amount of farming space. Yet you would be surprised to know that hydroponic farms are starting to pop up all over the place. But what exactly are these hydroponic farms and how do they work? Elena Brooks has the story.
When you do your grocery shopping, do you ever wonder where your fruit and veggies come from? Maybe you assume they're from a farm far, far away. But have you ever wondered if it's actually possible to farm in Sydney? The answer may surprise you. In Australia's largest city, farming certainly isn't the first thing that comes to mind. Yet scattered throughout Sydney, there are hydroponic farms, growing so much of the produce that we consume daily. That said, most people have never heard of hydroponics.
Have you ever heard of hydroponic farming?
No.
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 Hydro what?
No, I haven't.
No. No, I haven't.
Dr. Kim Yan Fantian is a horticultural lecturer and researcher at the University of Sydney. She explains the farming process.
It's a production system that is outside of the soil, and there's a couple of different ways this is done. There's something called a nutrient film technique, so the plant roots are kind of dangling in a thin layer of water or nutrient solution. But there are other systems where media is used. It's just not soil, so it might be something, for example, like a rock wool or some other...
of the Eora Nation. If you like the show, catch us again next week on Thursday nights from 7:30 p.m. I'm Miles Holbrook-Walk. Till next time.
Tart is the head of marketing for Hydro Produce, a hydroponic farm based in Silverwater in Sydney's west.
hydroponics adds such great value, I think to the whole offer of what customers get. I think there's so much value in the environmental positives around it. It uses 10% of the water that it would take to grow the same crop in the soil. It takes probably 10 times the land size to grow again the same volume. So for some things, especially things like your nice fancy lettuce varieties or your herbs, kale is another thing that we grow hydroponically. It ticks all the boxes. I think if you can get something to grow